Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, our panel explores the roots of the conflict in Sudan, the toll on civilians, and the silence surrounding the country's collapse. Since April 2023, brutal conflict between rival military factions has torn the country apart, displacing millions and unleashing a humanitarian catastrophe. Recorded live at the 2025 festival in partnership with Islamic Relief UK, explore what led to this war, why there has been a limited international response, and what hope remains for peace and justice.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming to this event. As you know, we are here to discuss a terrible conflict that has gone on for far too long and yet receives very little media coverage, very little public attention, and even little activist attention. So hopefully we can together throw some more light on this conflict and perhaps what little we can do to help alleviate things. I've got a really distinguished panel, so I'm really excited to be able to chair this. Rupa Goguneni is a Paris-based filmmaker who has been working from Nairobi for over a decade. So she has some really amazing frontline insights, and she has made a number of films about the crisis. So her recent documentaries have been made for the New York Times, the BBC, Al Jazeera, and I believe your latest film is available to watch online. So her website is rupagoguneni.com. You can check that out and you can find some of the films which are available online from her website, including, I think, a version of the newest one. I also have here with me Salman Sheikh, who is the founder and CEO of the Sheikh Group, which is specialized in peace building and conflict resolution. Salman has a focus on the Middle East and North Africa, a lot of experience in track-to diplomacy, previously directed the Brookings Institution's Doha Center, has served in the United Nations in a number of roles. And finally, last but not least, we have Professor, let me just scroll down to get your name correct, Owen Green, who heads up the Department of Peace Studies at Bradford University. He's had a 20-year career of writing papers and articles, 240 research articles to his name. Also was a director until very recently of the NGO Safer World, which has done a lot of work in the Sudan. So there's a lot to get through. And Rupa, I'd like to start with you. Maybe if you could give us an insight into your latest work and what the focus of that work is and how it relates to your previous films.
Sure. Thank you for that introduction. Hi, everybody. My name is Rupa. I'm a documentary filmmaker. I started my career in Nairobi, where I lived for a decade, which is where I started getting involved in Sudan. And yeah, so I've been working sort of in and around Sudan for the past 10 years. When I began, it was still under the regime of Omar al-Bashir. And so as a filmmaker and a journalist, and an American filmmaker and journalist, it was very hard to get a visa and to access Sudan, and so I was mostly working in rebel-held areas in South Kordofan, where you could access through South Sudan, and also with communities in exile. You know, loads of journalists and artists, human rights defenders were all in exile. Many of them in Nairobi, and that was sort of my community. And yeah, so I made films during that time, and then I made films during the revolution, which kicked off in December 2018 and successfully toppled the dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir after 30 years, after many, many armed revolutions, failed in this pursuit. So that the film that I was hoping to show clips from is Suddenly TV, which I filmed during one specific protest in Khartoum, which was after the fall of Bashir. But basically what had happened was the military of Burhan had sort of stepped in and they said, we'll give you civilian rule sort of down the line, but right now we're going to remain in power. And this is, of course, sort of not what the revolutionaries had gone to the streets for. And so they continued, the revolution continued, and they occupied the military headquarters. And yeah, and I thought they would never leave. They built this entire protest camp. They had a revolutionary corps of engineers that made a sort of an electric grid, and revolutionary doctors who'd set up clinics throughout the camp. It was an entire sort of self-sustaining city. And people from all over Sudan had sort of poured into Khartoum for this. And then eventually the protest was very violently destroyed by both the RSF and sort of under the sort of leadership of SAF as well, both of whom are players in this current war. So anyway, that happened, and then there was a military coup in which the military completely took over. Sorry, I'm kind of giving a very abbreviated history of what's happened in the past 5 years, because it's a lot. And as you said, it's been so poorly covered in the international media and kind of very poorly understood, because it is complex, and there's not a good side, and it's sometimes hard for journalists to write stories when they don't know, you know, there's not a good and an evil. So fast forward 2 years ago, April, well, more than 2 years ago now, April 2023, the war began between the RSF and SAF. And this is the analogy that I often use is sort of the Russian military and Wagner group fighting each other, and these two strong men, and civilians just caught in the middle. And this is a counter-revolutionary war. This is not a civil war. And so throughout this time, I was still working as a journalist and making films. And then I started doing more humanitarian work, as did sort of everybody I knew who had any connection to Sudan or was Sudanese. So part of this involved, I helped organize a delegation of emergency response room workers, these sort of grassroots humanitarian responders, to go to the US and try and connect with international donors. There's been a huge, huge gap in financial support for the crisis, which preceded the Trump administration. I mean, that was just sort of another blow. But Sudan, there's been sort of a lack of political will, I think, to respond to the situation in Sudan. And so it's been largely Sudanese who have had to take care of each other. It's been a lot of the diaspora who is sort of sending money to their local communities and their families. And it's been amazing to see the development of mutual aid, and how even in the absence of sort of big INGOs and international humanitarian groups, like, people keep each other alive. And that's sort of always been the case in Sudan. And there's always been, and I think to hear more about the work of Save Our World, who is obviously very engaged in this, Sudan kind of presented an opportunity to localize aid, which is something that people always talk about but never actually move towards. And this is like, the international actors can't access Sudan. And so you have to work with local communities that might not have 3 years of accounting to show, but they are doing the work. And so It was about building trust and making all of the, you know, all of the bureaucracy of aid a little less. So I've been sort of facilitating that work. And then also separately, I started a fund with some Sudanese colleagues, which supports, it's sort of a rotating fund modeled after traditional community savings groups in Sudan called Sanduk al-Sudan, which this is sort of a merry-go-round, is another word that we use in East Africa. But everybody pitches in, and then the pot of money goes towards a different local initiative every $10,000 collected, basically. So I've been doing that. And then also as a filmmaker and now kind of film programmer, I've started a network of film clubs sort of in different refugee communities across East Africa, where Sudanese refugees are watching films and having conversations. There's the online space in Sudan is super, super violent, super toxic. And so the kind of space that had been possible during the revolution is gone. And so with the film clubs, we're sort of trying to recreate these spaces, to just have to start conversations and to feel safe together. And so that's some of the other work.
Thank you. So you've been busy.
Yeah.
You've been really busy.
Well,
thank you for that. I mean, I think that's really useful opening into the context. Maybe Owen, if you could give us a sense of what you've seen, obviously, because you've actually also worked on the ground. You've done some track 2 diplomacy as well. You worked in South Sudan as well. And you also have said that you mentioned to me just before we started that you've worked in other parts of the region as well. So with that in mind, what is driving the intractability of this?
Now, thanks, and it's a pleasure to be here. Hi, and I'm looking forward to your questions. So I'll come back to what's driving it by giving a little bit of context and then coming back to it. I mean, one of the most astonishing things and astonishingly successful processes in my career in the Horn of Africa, I've worked elsewhere, but in the Horn of Africa, was the mobilization of NGOs and civilian groups during 2018 and 2017. They were entirely suppressed beforehand. And yet, and I know because there was a lot of sensitive work enabling those NGOs and civil groups to meet in the region, and I was participating in some of that. And so it didn't come from nowhere, but nevertheless, it was entirely surprising that the regime itself was not strong enough to immediately suppress that civilian uprising. Looking back, I don't want to go into, you know, detailed history, but it's quite possible that the ruling elites in Sudan were happy to get rid of al-Bashir but lacked the framework in which it could be done. And so when the uprising happened, they essentially refused to back him and then have been playing a game ever since. It was an amazingly inspiring process where suddenly things opened up between late 2018 for about 18 months, 2 years, and a very productive peace-building process, which was reflected in what's called the Juba Peace Accords. But the most important thing is to recognize what an important framework that is and was for any future peace in Sudan. It essentially recognized that most of the problems of Sudan throughout its history, including when it included South Sudan, was an entirely unaccountable, brutal, authoritarian Khartoum elite, which was essentially trying to run Sudan without recognizing the enormous diversity of the peoples and the cultures and all of that there, and certainly not delegating any authority and power. And so this peace process that took place in Juba was a very difficult one, but it was managed locally, and there were many, many tensions between different groups. But in the end, the peace process involved reforms at the center, but also a lot of building of institutions so that at least, well, in practice, 6 different regions of Sudan could begin to self-govern to a large extent. And there was a lot of opportunity behind it. Now, coming back to the drivers, during this time, it was a very uneasy relationship between them and the military. At that time, there wasn't an obvious split between RSF and the Sudanese. RSF stands for the Rapid Support Group, which is the groups that were responsible for the genocide in Darfur during the period 2003 onwards. But there wasn't an enormous split, although there was certainly rivalry between them because they're headed by 2 very charismatic individuals that want to move forward. But I trace the decision to topple the civilian government, which was always fragile, to the point where the civilian government was getting its act together to begin to hold accountable the security forces in Sudan for the way they were pillaging Sudan's resources, which is a tradition that's gone on ever since independence. And so obviously, one of the benefits of being in a very mineral-rich country and ruling it is you can pillage the resources. One of the characteristics of Sudan, including the period before South Sudan left, is that the elites seem quite comfortable with almost permanent conflict and war in the country. If there's permanent conflict and war, then you can loot with impunity. It's harder to be held accountable, and it helps provide resources for the militias that people in the elites at the center want to maintain, but they don't want to pay for, and so please go ahead and loot and all of that. And I think that, of course, there were many, many complex processes at work, but the key one is that the civilian governments were beginning to say, hold on, who's responsible for the natural resources here? Sudan is very rich in oil. It lost some of it to South Sudan, but it still has significant oil resources, very large gold deposits, which are being pillaged as we speak. So if we talk about drivers, I think they're almost entirely internal. They are primarily about elites, a coalition of elites that have run Sudan in all sorts of different configurations over the last, forever. And now they've reached a critical point. Do they allow the civilian venture to proceed, the government, and risk losing their access to resources, or do they topple it? And they toppled it, and then, of course, later they divided. So that would be one key driver. There are some external facilitating factors, though. One of them is that, I mean, as was mentioned, I've been involved, I was just reflecting, the first time I was involved in a track one, track two and a half, a track two type process in Sudan, which is track one simply means official, track two means unofficial, and track one and a half is quasi unofficial, but there are officials there. And that was a long time ago. But one of the advantages for some period was that there was a significant coalition of international actors that were keen to, when there are opportunities, to try and press for those opportunities for peace to take hold in Sudan. And the US was one of those. And a coalition that was powerful, that included diplomatically powerful, I mean, obviously US is militarily powerful, but which included the UK, Norway, a number of others, at the very minimum during the crisis, and this was something that happened, in fact, when the civilians took over, one of the things they did manage to do, they didn't affect much in domestically, but one of the things they did manage to do was persuade external actors to stay out and let the Sudanese do it themselves. In other words, don't get tempted, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Russia, you know, all of those, to sort of take sides. Can you just give them space? But there's been a change in geopolitical power. And so I think, you know, transitions. The US under Biden was very much weaker. You know, it's been weakening relative to Russia, China, Saudi Arabia, all of those sorts of states. This is just the way of the world. And so when it came to 2022-23, I know that there were superhuman, I mean, really intense efforts by that previous coalition to try and keep other states out, try and persuade them not to interfere, not to take sides in this emerging, re-emerging civil war. But of course, they failed. So they're not taking sides. They're trying to foster a diplomacy. There is a neutral diplomacy going on, but the real power is on the ground. And in that context, you know, Russia and UAE, Turkey, Saudi, Egypt, Libya, you know, Chad, they're all involved. And this is partly because they care about power in the neighborhood. And it's partly because there's very rich pickings. So what's the successor to the Wagner Group? And the Wagner Group is very actively operational in an area which is essentially about smuggling gold from South Sudan into the and so on and so forth. So it's shocking in that respect. But in the end, the externals are not driving it, except that they are providing weapons to help sustain the horrible character of this war. But it is internal. So two or three other points, if I may, before we pass on. Don't make the mistake of thinking that the rapid support forces and the Sudanese army are professional organizations which have got a commander. They have commanders and they declare obedience to those commanders. But the character of conflict in Sudan for a long time has essentially been you have coalitions of militia groups, strong people who align with whoever they think might win, in order that they may join the government if there's a peace, in order that they'll get share of the national resources. And so these forces are broadly consistently aligned with the RSF and Sudanese forces. But once it looks as though one side might win, you'll see quite a shift, which could help consolidate. Unfortunately, these forces are not fighting over anything except selfish access to wealth and power. Of course, there are many, you know, there have been many ideological dimensions in the past. Bashir talking about a specific vision of strict Islam and so on and so forth. But in the end, I think the scholarship is this is a rapacious set of national elites. It's utterly tragic. I've had an opportunity to work with the Nuba in certain areas and not in Darfur, but in the right over, just over the border, in Darfur with the Darfuris and so on. There are so many vibrant groups that have managed to survive this almost constant war ever since independence and before probably, but it's getting worse and worse for them. And, you know, these are groups, some of them have decided to take up arms in order to protect their identity group, and they have incentives then, and then those militias become aligned with one or other group or try and fight their own side. Others have learned maybe long ago that taking up arms just means the scale of repression against their community is much greater, and therefore they just retreat into this. In this context, finally, we're working in a rough neighborhood here, unfortunately. So Ethiopia luckily keeps out. Ethiopia sees itself, for complex reasons, even though there's been a civil war in Ethiopia recently, as one of those governments that could play a facilitating role if and when that opportunity is there. Not to say they fully keep out, but they do. On the other hand, there are overflow effects of the wars in Tigray and Eritrea, Ethiopia, which deeply affect the populations that live near Port Sudan. Any of you can remember that there was a time when all humanitarian aid had to get channeled through Port Sudan because nowhere else was feasible. Right now, I'm afraid we're in the position, we mentioned that my NGO has been very involved for a long, long time with South Sudan and Sudan, and so we know it. But the reality is you could have billions and billions and billions of dollars stacked up for humanitarian aid. The capacity to deliver it meaningfully in Sudan without it being just pillaged by one or other of the militia groups is very low. And so there are certain, you know, you can do a certain scale of aid, but it's limited by the scale of the conflict, unfortunately. And so, you know, it's well worth it. These self-help groups that you were talking about earlier certainly exist. They have to exist, and they always exist in these contexts, you know, people understanding their local context, making whatever they can. And the art of giving humanitarian aid at the moment is to work very dynamically and specifically with those self-help groups in order to empower them and give them access, normally to money rather than food and materials so that they can buy it on the illicit markets and so on. It's one of those things that can make you feel quite angry, but then you have to look back and think to 2018, 2019. There was a moment where there was a remarkable possibility for what would otherwise be an extraordinarily divided country with so many different languages, so many different identity groups, so many different histories. When they took the opportunity, they took it to develop a feasible way forward. And we can only hope that they'll have an opportunity again. But unfortunately, I think we're either just going to be unending war. As I said from the in the past, I mean, some people hope that at some point war weariness will mean the RSF and Sudanese army sort of come to some deal in some form. It'll either be dividing the country so they'd look after one bit and another bit of. But I don't see much incentive for that because they live with war. It's good for them. And so it's an elite that understands how to extract resources, and war conditions are very beneficial to it. So we're in for the long haul. And why is there less public? There used to be tremendous public attention to Sudanese conflict over a period of time. I think there is a sense in which if most of the key actors think they've got no ideas as to how to end it, except for urging restraint and all of that, in a sense, it's hard to generate the momentum for wide public's concern to try and mobilize that response. I think, you know, that there are opportunities, but if we're relying on the external community, we'll need to wait for that time until, with the change in the global power coalitions, there are other powerful states, in addition to the traditional Western states, that feel that it's in their interest to exert energy to try to urge constraint. And, you know, there are some developments. Qatar is trying to do a reasonable job, I think. It's not taking sides dramatically in this. And, you know, Saudi is hesitating, but it's not quite as all in as the Libyans and the Russians and the UAE. So, but I'm afraid, some of you will have heard me speak before, I say I'm somebody who's very much a glass half full. But right now it's a question of hanging on in there. But don't forget, the Sudanese people have hung on in there for 50 years. So I don't lack optimism that at some point things will come right, but I don't see any dynamic in the next year or two.
Well, thank you, Owen. That's really a very, very comprehensive
overview. Sorry to speak long.
Not at all. I mean, I think you've given us a masterclass, actually, in what's actually going on within the space of a few minutes. So thank you. Very, very useful. And I think this is a good foundation, Salman, to come to you, to give us a sense of exactly that. We're obviously dealing with an extremely complex situation. Now, you have some familiarity due to the work that you do with these complex efforts to deal with this. What is happening to deal with it? What's your sense of that complex geopolitics? Obviously, there's internal drivers, some of which Owen's described. There's the external players. What is happening now to kind of resolve this? What do you think of the response of the international community and the international institutions? where is it going, and is there hope?
Thank you. It's very good to be with you, and thank you for coming in your afternoon, and it's good to join this esteemed panel. There's always hope, and there should be hope, especially for a country like Sudan and its wonderful people. Owen referred to this remarkable efforts in 2017-18 and 19, which led to the overthrow of Bashir. These were remarkable events, and you know, when I headed Brookings, we were covering the Arab revolutions, bringing Syrians, Tunisians, Libyans, Yemenis, Egyptians together. And I have to say, some of the most impressive people and efforts I've seen are in Sudan, actually. So yes, there is hope. But let me step back for a second to explain how where we are right now. You've already heard the background and the context. You know, Sudan, since its independence in 1956, unfortunately, has been a highly volatile state, a nation state as such. It's gone more than 20 coups. Military rule of Bashir lasted more than 3 decades, 2 civil wars, etc. Today, there is a humanitarian crisis the like of which we don't have in the rest of the world. At least half of the population are in acute need. More than 500,000 children have probably died from malnutrition because of the famine that is taking place, in particularly on the western side, southern western side, which is being covered, but not enough as such. So it's a really desperate situation. Where I would slightly disagree with you, Owen, is that, yes, the elites are the drivers of this conflict, but I think it's now a regional conflict, and the actual fuel for it is being provided by the region. Yes, the established elites who have plundered Sudan, and let's remember Bashir, for example, gave one of the militia leaders in the RSF, Hemeti, formerly what was the Janjaweed and then the RSF, ownership of gold mines, for example. So yes, the elites have a stake in that regard, but what's been so disappointing, as part of perhaps broader geopolitical competition, the competition that has now led to really fueling this conflict inside Sudan. And it's not just the neighbors, it's the Gulf states, as you know, as well. So that is unfortunately the problem we face today. In terms of diplomacy, nothing seems to be working, I'm sorry to say. So there was an initial effort to ceasefire. There was the Jeddah agreement in 2023 with the role of Saudi Arabia, which is important in that regard. Yes, there was this coalition of both American and European actors which still try to engage, though I lament the fact that the Trump administration has sort of still not really found the senior officials to work on this. And remember, it's the United States that started to prescribe one of those militias for committing genocide in the southwest of the country. In fact, I think the Europeans, including the UK, are a bit lost right now. I give a huge amount of credit to David Lammy for his efforts to try and put Sudan back on the international community's agenda. He sponsored and he used his political diplomatic capital to bring a conference together of some of the main actors, European, American, Gulf, a couple of months ago. I think it had 3 aims, even though it wasn't stated as such. One was to try and address greater the situation of humanitarian access. The second was the protection of civilians. And the third was to get some sort of a political track going. On all three, there isn't that much progress at all. And it's safe to say, and we're speaking amongst friends right now, is that the Foreign Office is a bit lost in terms of how to try and create a viable political track. There are now track twos as well, as you've described, and it's been going on for years. There is an important track two which has been taking place in Switzerland called the NEON process. But again, certain Sudanese players or personalities are even forbidden to attend because one sponsoring country or another of some of the Sudanese diaspora doesn't want them there. So that's the difficulty that we face. In amongst all of that, yes, we in the Sheikh group have been trying to see, and by the way, we've avoided getting into Sudan for a long time because we felt others could do it better or were trying. So we didn't want to duplicate what they were doing. But over the last year or so, we have been looking at it in a more serious way. I first went with the UN, with the UN Special Representative for Children and Armed Conflict to Sudan in the late 90s. And we went to both South Sudan and the North as such. It's a completely different place in that respect. For us, it has been to particularly see how you can prize open a space where civilians can actually start to talk to each other. And the problem is that it's a race against time, actually. The longer the military conflict between the SAF and the RSF has continued, it is even cannibalizing the civilian track, sort of the co-option or the coercion of civilian groups and blocs and all of that. So it's a race against time to try and actually get a civilian track going, which I think everyone agrees, whether it's the Gulf, whether it's the Europeans, whether it's the Americans, whether it's those in the region, you do need a civilian track. How do you get that going? How do you get the space for something like that? So we're engaged, and here I won't say too much because it may not work and it's probably not useful, but what we are trying to do is to try and help create that space. And we are focusing on Gulf actors as much as we are, to be honest with you, with the Europeans and the Americans, in order to see that, can there be a space given for Sudanese personalities to come together and start to chart a course which would lead to a full-blown civilian national dialogue and to revive some of those incredible civilian efforts that we've seen before. I should also say one word for the emergency response rooms. These are Sudanese themselves, young people often who have been working on the ground to try and deliver aid to where it's most needed. There are at least 20 plus now of these.
Hundreds, 200
I was going to say, but 20, that are in 20 different areas of Sudan. And they've in fact been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. And I think they're very worthy candidates for the efforts that they've been making. And the challenge for those of us who are trying to work in the political spaces is how do we, without affecting their own impartiality, how do we bring those bottom-up civilian efforts also into consideration in terms of what they're trying to do?
Can I jump in there? Yeah. Because I think that's a really, I mean, in my mind, one of the biggest failings of the sort of negotiations and these talks that have happened and, you know, since the war began and before was the failure to include civilians. You know, there's always sort of civilian leadership, but it's not representative of the movement, you know, the movement that overthrew Bashir and had this nonviolent revolution. This movement is the network that is created the emergency response rooms, right? So these, the groups that are now, you know, keeping the power on and having soup kitchens and emergency healthcare facilities, they were formerly the people who were organizing the protests. So it's this sort of shift from organizing and demonstrating to now providing direct humanitarian aid. And it is very complicated because they cannot be seen as political. They cannot, but at the same time, they are effectively serving, they are providing the services of a state, you know? And so in my mind, it's like all of this, I hope at the end of this, people will recognize that the people that have in fact been sustaining Sudan are in fact this network of very qualified, very trained, impressive young people, and they're everywhere, you know.
That's the dilemma we face and many face in terms of how do you bring the bottom up with the top down? Because those elites, even if they don't have the same amount of credibility really on the ground, because of the sponsorship and support that they are getting. And, you know, the RSF has now got drones. They've got, both sides have got anti-aircraft stuff. There is more and more, in fact, weapons which are coming in. And how do you, at the same time, sustain the ability of these civilian forces to be able to provide support to the people on the ground?
I mean, I think there's very clear things that they're demanding right now, which is recognition as humanitarian actors. I mean, they're not being protected in the same way that humanitarians are traditionally, and yet they're doing the work of humanitarians, and they are being co-opted in a lot of ways and threatened and shut down by both sides. And so it's about protecting their work.
That's why I said this is a race against time, because the longer this conflict continues and intensifies, nobody's going to win, by the way. It's going to be a back and forth. So somebody takes a piece of land, somebody... Now, the SAF has certainly had progress in the last year or so, particularly in overtaking and going into the capital now, Khartoum, and the RSF being more and more confined to the western side. So we do need a civilian track which is able to harness precisely this kind of element, if I could just finish. The longer this continues, though, we are actually facing a situation where it gets more and more out of control. We are, in fact, facing, in my view, and you talk about glass half full or empty, if these efforts don't work and if we don't have the international community being able to be truly effective in supporting these kind of civilian efforts and a civilian track, we're actually looking at the disintegration of Sudan. And not only the disintegration of Sudan, but something that's going to affect the entire Horn of Africa, which is already a very fragile place at this moment in time. And in fact, a belt of conflict which goes all the way from the west of Africa to the Red Sea. And so let's hope that key international actors, Gulf states included, are able to find a consensus that can allow these kinds of things to happen. I should finally say that in our own efforts, we've actually been encouraged, and we just hope. In diplomacy, it's about ripeness. We hope that this is we're now entering into a more ripe period for the space to be given for these efforts.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think this is a really interesting debate. What I think we should do is open the floor and let's have you guys ask some questions. Do you have any burning questions? Put your hand up and we'll get the mic round. So,
can I just ask, is there anyone from Sudan here?
No.
Okay.
Doesn't look like it. Okay, so we've got two questions. So one is focused on, is the governability of Sudan, section something off, and the role of the African Union? Yeah, Owen, please go ahead.
Yeah, I'm happy to start on those. Both are ones that I've spent a lot of time reflecting on and talking. But I think Sudan is very governable, if only the elites had attempted ever to govern it properly. One of the remarkable things about Sudan is, of course, it's a post-colonial creation, as are so many, but Sudanese feel Sudanese. So when that moment arrived for where there was an opening, an opportunity for that civilian government, there was a lot of mutual recognition that they're very different, but that it wasn't secessionist, it was more a question of what sort of level of regional autonomy should there be? And so in that sense, I mean, there was maybe one way of answering, further elaborating on that question, is when the peace, so-called, was made with South Sudan, I mean, forced on Sudan, basically, Sudan elites were essentially told that they would, that outside actors, particularly the United States, would never let them win the war against South Sudan. So they'd better come to some accommodation. And that took 10 years to quite, materialize. But when that peace took place between South Sudan and North Sudan, there were a lot of parts of what is now Sudan that thought, we're South Sudan, we want independence from Sudan. That was certainly true of the Nuba areas, the two Nile states. It was true of parts of Kadafur, which is just north of South Sudan, and with slightly more complex elements, the Darfur region. These were areas that had always been suppressed by Khartoum, couldn't see any big future in being left with Khartoum, and if they had a choice, they'd prefer to go with South Sudan. Looking back, that was tricky, but essentially the diplomacy of that would have been too complicated. People wanted an agreement between what was, what had been long identified as South Sudan, and so they were essentially forced to continue to stick with the Sudanese state, with all sorts of words about how the Sudanese state would provide more accommodation to them, which it never tried to for a moment. So there are, I mean, in principle, there are all sorts, it's a very large country. one could imagine all sorts of ways in which it could disintegrate in the way you say. But I agree with what you were saying, incidentally. I think there is a threat of disintegration, and there is a threat, and it's already becoming a regional conflict in various ways. I agree with that. But in the end, I think it's hard, the real solution is for a civilian track led by similar groups that were previously involved. It was very inspiring. Now, this is a traditional country, but women's groups within this civilian authority were very much empowered, and they had very important part in defining the Juba Peace Accords, and there were all sorts of agreements. And the reason why they had to be split into six regions was that social conservatism was more extreme in some areas than others and all of that. So in that sense, I would say, although probably most parts of Sudan at present, if they could be extracted from the rest of the civil war, they would self-govern and govern quite happily. But I doubt they'll be allowed to be. And it's not quite the vision of most Sudanese. You know, they are looking for a national solution. In relation to the African Union, again, I've worked a lot with the African Union. I'm often in their headquarters, and right now we have a project which allows me a special insight into this. The challenge with African Union is that, I mean, it's partly one of resources. So African Union can ask for money, but their own African states don't contribute to African Union. They don't contribute to the budgets very much. And therefore, they're always going to Japan, United States, and the European Union, and via the UN, to get the resources. So it's partly a resource issue, but here it's a political issue. And there are two issues. One is, although in principle the African Union can take action even if there isn't full consensus, in practice they're quite reluctant to do it. And the fact that you have Chad, Libya, Egypt on different sides in this conflict means that they find it very hard to get to grips with. So what they do at present, I'm afraid, it's a bit like the UN. They issue regular communiques asking for restraint, asking for humanitarian action, asking for a political track, but with very little weight behind it. And the challenge is this isn't an area of relative strength for the African Union. Although the African Union works for the whole of Africa, in practice it works better for sub-Saharan Africa. The Horn of Africa, because the identities of North Africa are very much MENA, Middle East, North Africa type. And so it's although in principle its mandate applies equally to there, in practice it's not used to mobilizing coalitions to deal with things in the Horn of Africa or North Africa. There's one final issue, and that is the momentum has gone out of a lot of member states in Africa campaigning for human rights, humanitarian affairs, constitutional government. It was a really driving, on a normative level, the African Union, despite the fact that it had opposition from lots of dictators in Africa, you know, there was a coalition that was willing to really push that. But some of those have sort of lost confidence because they see which way the international wind is blowing, which means that relative authoritarians that used to think they'd better at least give lip service to democracy now don't think they need to, because they can insult the West as much as they like and they won't be lacking in international support. And anyway, Trump obviously is an indicator that, you know, the US at least is less bothered with these things. And so what that means is that coalition, it's not a formal mandate thing. It's the fact that you could mobilize very powerful African coalitions to try and sort of say, this is not good enough, you know, on a pan-Africanist sort of normative tradition. But just in the last few years, it's not that the leaders of that have lost their own momentum. It's just winning those coalitions, expecting that they would actually get a majority vote in any UN African Union meeting. They've lost confidence. Obviously, there have been coups in West Africa. There's a sort of change of dynamic in other parts too. And so it's a sad story. But there are still really inspiring, good people in the African Union and associated with it are trying to do their bit. But I'm afraid it's not often mentioned as part of the process.
I mean, on that note, I mean, obviously, so we've described some of the big institutions and some of the intractability. I mean, Rupa, I'd like to come back to you. And you were really emphasizing the civilian work that you've seen. Please, let's remind us of that work, remind us of the scale of it. And I think you were really emphasizing that there's been a deficit here in the response. I'd like us to tackle that, because we've covered a lot of the intractability and the problems. And it sounds to me like there's something here. There's something about something, there's a trick that we're missing. And it's all to do with this nascent civilian movement that did give rise to a democratic uprising before. And yet somehow the international community seems to have overlooked this. What's your take on this issue? And what are you seeing on the ground?
I mean, part of it, within these institutions, there are people who have worked in Sudan and have relationships with Sudan for, you know, decades, and they want to give to these groups, right? But there is a lot, again, as I said, of bureaucracy in the way. It, for example, when USAID gives a grant, it can only give a grant at a certain scale, and it requires basically a team of accountants which don't exist. And so there's this kind of problem, right? And it's about accountability, it's about sort of tracing money and all of this, but there is a solution. They have, I mean, these groups have been working, they know this, and they have been working on creating systems that sort of are transparent and can work with the international donors. And if there are billions of dollars around, there are ways to spend it in Sudan. There's this network of emergency response rooms, which we've briefly described, which again is hundreds of response rooms around the country. And these include both, you know, they're doing emergency medical relief, but also food. And there's women's response rooms that deal with psychosocial support. And it's a very kind of complex, well-run, hyper-local network. And although they are all autonomous, and this is important, I mean, I think because historically Sudan has been so dominated by Khartoum and an Arab elite, it's really critical, and it has been sort of throughout the revolution and in this civilian response, that it's grassroots and not centralized. And this is part of the issue, which is, you know, which has contributed to the lack of, I think, civilian sort of leadership, because you can't step up and identify yourself as a leader. You immediately lose credibility within Sudanese people. And so it means that there's no kind of spokesperson for this movement. It's sort of intentionally horizontal. But they do have, again, they sort of operate autonomously, but they have a central finance coordination committee. And this is, and then there separately is something called the LCC, which is the Localization Council. And this is made up of a number of Sudanese humanitarians that have been involved in different NGOs for many, many years, very experienced. And so now there is a mechanism by which you can donate large amounts of money to an American nonprofit that then funnels money directly to the LCC, which responds to the needs of the ERRs on the ground and allocates things accordingly and quickly. And so they do now have mechanisms to receive like big money. There was one other thing I was going to say, just to your question about the local sort of independence movements. I mean, I think, again, because Sudan has been such a kind of, Sudan is a colonial construct. I mean, there are many, many sort of kingdoms and groups within Sudan, and they have kind of survived without, it, or in spite of their central government. In South Kordofan, there is one, in the Nuba Mountains, there is one armed movement, the SPLA North, Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, which had formerly fought alongside the South Sudanese rebels, as Professor Green said. And now they are effectively an autonomous state. I mean, they have their own rebel army, they have their own rebel administration, government, everything, education system. And they have some gold, which they, you know, use to finance everything. And so there are places like that, and it's sort of led by a charismatic leader named Abdelaziz, who's like an old school African socialist. And there are kind of pockets like that. I mean, that's sort of the most developed and functioning. But I think, you know, it's sad, and there is this sort of balkanization that's happening in Sudan. But I also, it's not, and of course it's this horrible, horrible war. But in a way, it's always been like that, you know. And I worked a lot also in Somalia, and it's reminding me more and more of Somalia, where there's things function in dysfunction. You know, it's not, there's this sort of nation, this notion of a nation state functioning in this specific way doesn't always make sense. And that could very well be an outcome of this war.
Salma, please.
Yeah, you've thrown open a very deep question, and I respect the answers that you already heard. Sudan is, in the modern day, is an artificial construct, yes, in terms of... But then we have to ask ourselves the question, what is best to deliver the well-being and safety of the people of that land? The preference should certainly be that civilians are able to rule over this land and then decide how they organize themselves. So I would be very wary of the Balkanization of Sudan. I would wish, of course, Sudanese to be able to decide what level of autonomy or localism and regionalism that they design. And that's probably a better path towards the well-being and protection of the Sudanese. And they've shown themselves capable to actually be able to do that if they're given the space and support that they deserve, vis-a-vis the elites that have continued to sort of haunt over them. Otherwise, we may well have a situation where a peace breaks off. Let's take southern Sudan. Is it stable today? No. And so you will continue to have an atomization until when do you stop? And that won't stop just in and around those areas, because the weakness of those areas then invites others to try and fill the vacuum as well. It doesn't stay just in those areas as such. So I think there's no substitute for the hard work that needs to be done in order to enable a proper diplomatic civilian track, which certainly is inspired and includes the kinds of civilians that Rupa's been talking about. We have people inside Sudan who are trying to identify and see, but here's the difficulty and the dilemma. You try and bring some of them into a political role, you're going to start killing the role that they're playing right now. So you've got to find some sort of a balance or some set of those who are even willing to be part of it, at least at this stage. And one of the lessons that we've learned from other processes which have failed over and again is the lack of preparation. So that is what we are trying, and others are trying to contribute to. Sudanese have been put together recently way too quickly without actually preparing the base, the foundations of how civilians want to take this process forward. And as part of that, of course, is a ceasefire, or at least more and more of an absence of conflict, which otherwise is going to continue to engulf any effort for civilians to be able to take over this. And this is where actually the international community, the African Union, the UN, but most importantly, member states can and should be doing a lot more. I actually agree with David Lammy that I think it's racism that Sudan has not received more attention in our capitals and more of an effort. Yes, they've done that in the past, but there seems to be a certain resignation. And that it doesn't have to be that way, in my view. There are powerful states who should be able to put pressure on others who are now fueling this conflict.
Can I just add one tiny thing?
Well, we are actually out of time.
Oh, aren't we? I thought we've got another 15 minutes.
No, I'm afraid not. But we are here. So if you do have any questions, want to continue the conversation, by all means, please do come and speak to our guests. Thank you very much for coming. I hope that was helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.